I'll begin by saying that today is the autumnal equinox, the fall equinox, a planet-wide event. This is one of 2 days of the year when there's exactly 12 hours of day and 12 hours of night everywhere on the planet. The other, of course, is the other equinox in the spring. And of course, in the Northern Hemisphere, for the last 6 months, we've had more sunlight than nighttime. And it'll be reversed. In the next 6 months, we'll have more nighttime than sunlight. And of course, the Southern Hemisphere has the opposite. You know, as we're moving into our dark winter months, they're moving into their bright summer months. Today is one of 2 days of the year when the sun rises exactly east and sets exactly west. See, all summer long, the sun has been rising northeast and has been making this wonderfully long arc around the sky and setting northwest. We've had nice long days. But today, just perfect east, perfect west. And then as we move into winter, the points of rising and setting will move further and further south. So we'll get these tiny arcs rising in the southeast, setting in the southwest. And the days will get shorter and shorter. Today is dawn at the South Pole. And for the next 6 months, the South Pole will have 24 hours a day uninterrupted sunlight. Today is dusk at the North Pole. And for the next 6 months, there'll be uninterrupted night at the North Pole. And in fact, that circle of 24 hours of uninterrupted night expands. And in fact, it fills the entire Arctic Circle by the middle of winter. So there are entire cities that have, you know, at least a few days of 24 hours a day uninterrupted night around the solstice. And so the equinox, especially the autumn equinox, it's a powerful event. It really is the root of the Jewish high holy days that happen this time of year. There is a more archaic Christian holiday that occurs, Michaelmas, the Feast of St. Michael, our name day, as a matter of fact. It was big in the Middle Ages, and I think in England they still talk about a Michaelmas term for the universities. But so I thought about what theme would be appropriate on the equinox, and what occurred to me was dealing with the unknown, looking into the darkness of the unknown. And so I thought I would talk a little about what we do when we're facing the unknown. And the unknown has several forms. I mean, certainly the future is unknown. And in particular, if things have been stable for a while in some area of our life, and then suddenly they become unstable, then the future becomes particularly noticeably unknown. But there's also the unknown just in the world, and especially in other people, you know. Sometimes people with whom we have to interact, you know. What's going on with that person? What are their motives, you know? And the funny thing about the future is, you know, I have no idea what's going to happen next year, but next year I'll know, you know. In other words, there's a guarantee that sooner or later I'll arrive in the future. And, you know, but with the unknown with another person, we may never know, you know. Or with a situation, you know. Now, of course, Buddhism teaches us to remain present, that all life, all vitality is in the present moment, and when our attention is present, we feel most vital. When my present starts to get scattered into past or future, then I feel disconnected from my own vitality, because my own vitality is not in the past or the future, it's only here in the present moment. But it's a very hard thing when we're facing the unknown to remain present. there's a great tendency of the mind to go into story, you know, and when it's the future, it might be stories of worry about everything that's going wrong. It might be stories of, you know, fantasy-driven expectations of everything that's going to be wonderful and over the top about the future, you know. About other people, it can be all our stories about, oh, I'm sure this is going, and this, you know, I know this is what he's doing, you know, this sort of thing. The mind loves to go into story because story gives the illusion of control. You know, we don't actually control the future by worrying about it, but there's a feeling that we're doing something. You know, there's a feeling like there's something I'm actually controlling by doing that. Or when I'm running my, you know, everything's going to be blissful fantasy, you know, either or. And there's something very vulnerable about the letting go, about the acknowledging some things are unknown and I have no control over them, you know. And it's implicitly Buddhism is asking us just to sit in that vulnerability, you know, which actually is a very fertile and creative place, but it's an uncomfortable place to occupy. Carl Jung talked about how when we look into the unknown, whether it's the unknown future or the unknown and, you know, another person or something like this, we tend to project our own unconscious. We, as it were, we paper it over with ourselves. And in that sense, the unknown, it can be quite revealing to notice the patterns. You know, what are the patterns that you project every time you're faced with the unknown? And these patterns might actually be, in a Jungian point of view, a picture of some of the forces that you're carrying around in your unconscious. You know? So it can be an interesting kind of test case. Now, one of the amazing things about the human brain is that it's actually designed to handle the unknown in a way. You know, we can't really program a computer to, like, here's what you do when you don't know what to do. Like, we can't program a computer to do that. But that's exactly how the mind is designed. And we actually have this amazing system, and it's down in the emotional center of the brain, the limbic system, where all this happens. In fact, where in fact all decisions really happen in the limbic system. And it's an organ that you might have heard of called the amygdala. And the amygdala governs the mammalian response to novelty. So in other words, in all mammals, it plays out the same way. It triggers two systems in succession when we're exposed to novelty. And so think about a very simple system. Say you have a rat. You know, and the rat's in some environment that it likes. And you put in something that the rat has never seen before, like a ticking metal ball or something like this. First thing the rat does is panics, like, oh my God, is this thing going to eat me? You know? And so for a while, it's just in complete fear. And then, after a certain while, it realizes it's not going to be destroyed. Then it gets curious. And then it walks over and, like, you know, basically, can I eat it? You know, a rat's needs are relatively basic, you know? And then it, you know, explores it, sniffs it, bumps it around, and then once it figures out it can't really get anything of benefit about it, then it loses all interest in it, you know? But those two systems, one is fear, and the other is what you might call a forward approach or curiosity system. And in many ways, the hero myth, you could say, is the classical archetypal hero myth as laid out by Joseph Campbell is, you might say, technology that allows us to understand this dynamic, technology that allows us to realize that when I'm faced with the unknown, yes, fear is going to come up, but I'm going to have to move through that fear in order to have this rewarding experience of exploring and growing. you know, some of the ancient myths, you know, in the Enuma Elish, one of the precursors of the Bible, really, the book of Genesis, in many ways, draws on the imagery of the Enuma Elish. Marduk faces this horrible sea monster, Tiamat. And, you know, he goes and faces the monster and slits the monster open. Kind of, the description is kind of slits her open like a seashell, you know, and creates these two halves and then creates the heaven and earth out of these halves of Tiamat. And it's a rich metaphor. When we face the unknown, at first the unknown can be a monster, you know. You know, I don't want to face that. That looks scary. You know, it can trigger us. It can be, it can present as a kind of monster. Once we move through that and get to the trigger, the second system, the one that's in forward approach and curiosity, then we, as it were, create a world. We discover a new world. Now, I will say one feature of the unknown. If sometimes we choose to go after the unknown, sometimes we choose, I'm going to explore this new thing, you know, kind of thing. Sometimes life thrusts us into the unknown. And in particular, if the thrusting into the unknown is an experience of loss, you know, losing a job, losing a relationship, losing a place of dwelling, that sort of thing. Then it may well be that we need to go through a grief process before we can ever even begin to think about, you know, exploring and opening new worlds and that sort of thing. You know, it's very important to give the psyche its time to grieve if there's been an experience of loss. So I have a quote sheet. I almost always have a quote sheet because I'm a teacher, so I have handouts, you know. And the first quote is this classical quote from Joseph Campbell about the hero myth. Furthermore, we have not even to risk the adventure alone, for the heroes of all time have gone before us. The labyrinth is thoroughly known. We have only to follow the thread of the hero path. And where we had thought to find an abomination, we will find a god. And where we had thought to slay another, we shall slay ourselves. And when we had thought to travel outward, we shall come to the center of our own existence. And where we had thought to be alone, we shall be with all the world. Kierkegaard tells us, life can only be understood backwards, but it must be lived forward. Great quote. Carl Jung says, we must be able to let things happen in the psyche. For us, this is actually an art of which few people know anything. Consciousness is forever interfering, helping, correcting, negating, and never leaving the simple growth of the psychic processes in peace. It would be simple enough if only simplicity were not the most difficult of all things. That's a profound statement of the problem of Buddhism right there. Jung also says, your visions will become clear only when you can look into your own heart. Whoever looks outside dreams, whoever looks inside awakes. This whole thing that we're projecting our unconscious when we're looking at the unknown. Anton de Saint-Exupéry, the author of The Little Prince, says, a single event can awaken within us a stranger totally unknown to us. To live is to be slowly born. And I love that idea, that single event can bring out something of me that I'm thinking, wait, who is that? You know? Beryl Markham says, I've learned that if you must leave a place that you have lived in and loved, and where your yesteryears are buried deep, leave it any way except a slow way. Leave it the fastest way you can. Never turn back and never believe that an hour you remember is a better hour because it is dead. Past years seem safe ones, vanquished ones, while the future lives in a cloud, formidable from a distance. And this whole problem of ways that we sometimes idealize the past at the expense of the future. Anais Nin says simply, we don't see the world as it is. We see it as we are. So true. Camus says, real generosity toward the future lies in giving all to the present. Which again is a deeply Buddhist idea. The poet Wislawa Szymborska says, when I pronounce the word future, the first syllable already belongs to the past. When I pronounce the word silence, I destroy it. Mark Helprin says, don't worry about things that you simply cannot know. Let them fall back and recede like the foam pushed aside by the flanks of a ship. Leave them behind and let your heart power on. The Buddhist teacher Pema Chodron says, letting there be room for not knowing is the most important thing of all. When there's a big disappointment, we don't know if that's the end of the story. It may be just the beginning of a great adventure. Life is like that. We don't know anything. We call something bad, we call it good, but we really just don't know. Esmeralda Santiago says, how can you know what you're capable of if you don't embrace the unknown? Terry Hayes says, the world doesn't change in front of your eyes. It changes behind your back. I love that. Luis de Berniz says, remember that fear causes to happen the very thing it fears. That's why fear should be unknown to us. Cornelia Funk says, nothing is more frightening than a fear you cannot name. Rick Riordan says, knowing too much of your future is never a good thing. John Green says, you spend your whole life stuck in the labyrinth, thinking about how you're going to escape one day and how awesome it will be, and imagining that future keeps you going, but you never do it. You just use the future to escape the present. Ernest Yeovil says, the uncertainties in life are so uncertain for us to determine the kind woe we shall entangle in the next future. When you stay dormant, your life is at risk. When you dare to take a step, you take a step to take a risk. That's a choice. Yes, a choice to choose to dare to get to our real reason on earth, or a choice to live in mediocrity or conformity. But we ought to note that it is riskier to risk nothing when the life we live is always at risk. That's a deep and somewhat confusing statement there. Kilroy Ulster says, the great beauty of life is its mystery, the inability to know what course our life will take, and diligently work to transmute into our final form based on a lifetime of constant discovery and enterprising effort. Accepting the unknown and unknowable eliminates regret. Dr. Debishis Mishra says, life is a daring adventure toward an unknown future. The beauty depends on how much you enjoy the journey. And Roy T. Bennett says, do not let the memories of your past limit the potential of your future. There are no limits to what you can achieve on your journey through life, except in your mind.